Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Voices of Hope. This week on the podcast, we have Mark. He is the owner and founder of Castrock Beer Company here in town. Our group Theology on Tap meets there every second Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m., which will be April 12th, and we will be talking about the Holy Spirit. So bring your questions, your thoughts, your concerns, your wonderings, and we'll discuss all those over a nice cold beer. Mark has been great to let us meet there and use his area and space. So come check it out. Come meet Mark. And this conversation is great because we talk about the history of beer in America and the world and how pubs have become a place for fellowship for people. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, Mark, thanks for joining me today. Tell me a little bit about how you got into brewing beer and how that led you to opening a brewery here in Castle Rock.
Started doing the hobby as a home brewer probably about 14 years ago or so, and it was always a hobby. So this was something in not so much the garage, but in the kitchen and the basement and whatnot. We looked at started doing a project of this scope in terms of the brewery probably 6 years ago now, because it was an interesting opportunity in terms of business. Living here in Colorado, you get to see all of the breweries that have been coming up and around the last couple of years, 10, 15 years. And it's always good stuff, and that was a community that we wanted to be a part of. And so we started looking at where can we set one up, where can we get one going. We looked at and worked with a number of project areas in Sheridan, up in Denver, Inglewood, Littleton, Castle Rock, and eventually settled here in Castle Rock, putting this together. We started the lease on our space in 2015, started doing construction. It took about 6 months to get all the construction done and all the licenses in place to be able to open up, and we opened up in January of 2016.
So what drew you to beer and wanting to brew your own? Because everybody likes, well, most people like beer,
yes,
right? But they're content just going out and buying their own. Why did you want to make your own?
When I got started in the hobby, it was, you have to remember, this was coming up on almost 15 years ago. It was easier to brew a better quality bottle of beer at home than it was to be able to get in the stores. That's no longer the case anymore. There's such amazing selection and quality that's available out in the liquor stores now that it's, if you're getting into the hobby, you're getting into it because you love the process. But I liked the process. It was fun. There's an element of cooking to it. So if you like being a chef or coming up with your own recipes and stuff, there's that. There's a lot of science that comes into it. And it became just something to do at home, to be able to make some beer and have a keg of beer that's my own and just be able to go grab it and pour myself a pint at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And just have it around.
Yeah. So what makes your we come here to do Theology on Tap. And one thing that Charlie always likes to – remind new people that come in that the beer is a little bit different than most microbreweries.
It's
around.
Different than what you'll see in the modern context, yes.
Yes.
In the last 5 years, you've seen a lot of the breweries, especially here in Colorado, start focusing more on the American styles. And what we have focused on is the classic heritage British styles. Mm-hmm. The history of brewing as a very generality can be parsed down into British, which would be ales, and then German, which would be lagers. It's a little too simplistic than what the reality is, but that's the easiest way to describe it to people. And what we're focusing on is we're focusing on those kind of classic British ales, the originations of reds and porters and stouts and IPAs and things like that, that are not the American version. Much of the craft beer scene that exists now, especially some of the big guys out there here in Colorado, you got New Belgium, which is on the Belgian side, but you have Odell's, you have Great Divide, you have Boulder Beer, who's been around forever, Walnut Brewing, who was around for a long time, and they closed recently. And then you get out to some of the other areas like Sierra Nevada and things like that. They made their bones and they made their companies as big as they are based on these older styles. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of a throwback to what craft beer was, even just 10 years ago, than some ancient form of beer. The scene, for whatever reason, has kind of moved on into the more experimental range, and these are more classically heritage.
Yeah, like putting
Lucky Charms into beer, or
any number of
like
things.
That.
And
you have
there's all kinds of new spices and fruits and things like that, because people, brewers, some tend to be a little more creative than others, and they'll wander. I mean, you wander into an Asian supermarket, and all of a sudden go, wait, what's that thing? Oh, it's a dragon fruit. Well, shoot, let's cut that up and put it in beer.
Yeah.
See what it tastes like.
Yeah.
There's that element of experimentation, which is fine, and there's the ability to try to make yourself unique and do something with something else that no one else has ever done in it before. And you've seen that the last couple of years, but it becomes a bit of a one-upsmanship game. It's like, okay, well, who can do this? Who can use this ingredient better? Who can? That's fine, and there's a market out there for it, and we're just not interested in being a part of that. We're interested in we want classic. We want something that you're not thinking about. This is just easy drinking, the beers that go with food, that go with friends and company, and something you're sitting in enjoying while chatting with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things I appreciate about your beer, because I think every single one, I think I've tried almost everything on the menu,
mm-hmm.
and I like the smoothness of all of them that we can drink with anything. Some craft brewery places, it depends on the beer, but it's a little bit harsh or you can taste alcohol too much type of thing.
Yeah, you'll get some of those elements where you get beers that are a little too boozy for what they really should be. Or you get certain flavor profiles that for whatever reason they hit your palate and you kind of go, that's not quite right. And some people know why, and others kind of go, I don't know enough, but yeah, it's not what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going for that kind of classic smoothness, that ability. We don't want beer to be the focus. We want people to come in, have a pint, but not focus on the pint.
Yeah.
The pint is just there as the social lubricant, as it has been the way beer has been for centuries. It's the social lubricant. It's there in the background to be enjoyed while doing whatever else, working or chatting with people or just vegging. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I come in here to prep my sermons, and I have a beer while I do that. It's good.
Hey.
It works well.
Whatever works.
Yeah. But some people, when they hear that, when I tell them about that at church, they're like, oh, that makes so much more sense now.
and I'm glad that you're not getting too much blowback, because I think some of it, beer, especially amongst the church, has been kind of look down on it. Alcohol, but wine has been served in the church and all the various aspects of Christianity for centuries. And in fact, you go back far enough into England and in Germany, the church was built on beer. You have to remember that the modern era and the ability to go, we take it so for granted, Americans. You walk into a restaurant, oh, what can we get you to drink to start with? Oh, I'll take a glass of water, and then you'll look at the menu from there. You can do that now in Europe, but the most of the rest of the world, you go to Thailand, you ask for a glass of water, they're going to look at you cross-eyed because you don't want it.
You don't
it will kill
water.
You.
Yeah,
yeah, it's dangerous. And it was that way for a long time before you had modern sanitation. And so the Catholic Church, I forget which monk, there's a couple of monks that actually went out there. They're like, no, don't drink the water. It's terrible. It's bad for you. They didn't know why. They didn't know bacteria. They didn't know viruses. They didn't know what they were. They just knew that water was making people sick.
Yeah.
And so they went, drink beer instead. And again, they didn't know why, but it's because the process of beer, you boil it.
Mm-hmm.
It naturally kind of sanitizes the whole thing. But they didn't understand that until later into the 1700s.
Yeah.
So the Christian, all the various facets of the Christian church were built on beer and wine and other things. It's just, it's a part of the symbolism of how you get to here.
I remember in seminary, we talked about Martin Luther, and he would write these letters when he would go around from church to church in Europe. He would write letters back to his wife,
mm-hmm.
Telling her how he missed her beer. Like, she would brew beer for him, and that when he was on the road, he missed her beer, and that he couldn't wait till he got home so he could have that. I think John Calvin was somebody who got paid in either beer or wine.
Mm-hmm. That would have been very typical.
Yep.
For a lot of things. You go back through the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
Sailors, army guys, everything. Part of their daily ration was beer,
mm-hmm.
and usually like a gallon or a gallon and a half a day. And so the army was in charge of trying to make sure that these guys had all that. They did beer on the naval ships up to a point, and then they eventually became rum because beer doesn't hold super well on, mm-hmm. on ships.
Right.
But yeah, you have there was a whole monetary aspect around beer. And yes, and Luther talking about his wife, everyone thinks of brewing now as, of course, the brewmaster, the man in the back going. You realize that it being a male industry didn't start happening until somewhere in the 1800s. before then, the brewers were all women. I mean, going all the way back, it was part of the female workload. They were the ones that were making the beer. The guys were out doing other stuff. They were tilling the farms and the soil and hunting and all that. Beer was a lady's job. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until it became a profession, quote unquote, for monetary reasons, along with the Industrial Revolution, a couple of things, that it became a male's job again.
Yeah.
Kind of one of those oddities.
Huh. That's interesting. I have a book at home called God and Guinness, and it's a story of the Guinness family and Guinness beer. And I think going back to what you were saying, that for a long time, the water wasn't good to drink.
No.
And so Guinness, especially during, there was a time in Irish history that the water was specifically bad.
You're probably on the run-up of the Industrial Revolution. You have to remember, a lot of people, yes, you had wells and they had areas, a lot of people were pulling their water and everything else that they used from the rivers. Mm-hmm. Well, with Industrial Revolution happening, the rivers were also, and we still do it today, they became the main source of, well, how do you get rid of waste product?
Right.
You throw it in the water because it would wash downstream, and whatever was downstream from you, you didn't care about.
Yeah.
And so you see that all over Europe and things like that. And it becomes an issue because it depends on what starts going into the water. I mean, you talk about even here in this country, uh-huh. the great river fires in Pittsburgh and in Cleveland. Uh-huh. And all, it's like, wait, the river's on fire. Wait, how's the river on fire? Exactly. There's so much junk in it that it ignites and goes. Mm-hmm. And so you have to remember, people were getting their water from that too. So,
well, and during this time, the Guinness family would give beer out to people so that they had something nutritious.
Yes.
To drink.
There is that element that was put in because beer was a form of it was stumbled across probably back. I mean, they're finding now that the Egyptians, as they're building the pyramids, were actually rationed in beer. I mean, it was part of their ration. Beer became a way of storing grain for the longer term. You just happen to be doing it in a liquid form, but it was stumbled upon by somebody.
Yeah.
And they kind of, oh wait, hold on, let's replicate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's this show on, I think it was Discovery Channel it was like only one season, but it was the guy who founded
Sam Calione from the Dogfish Head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I watched
Brewmaster or something like that.
Yeah. And it was only like six episodes, but
yes.
It showed him going all over the world
mm-hmm.
and kind of looking at how people do beer and like these tiny villages in South America and Africa and things like that, and trying to recreate that.
Bring some of those elements back in.
Yep.
Yeah. And what you see, the thread that ties everything together is that you're basically seeing they're using a grain product, whether that grain was millet or barley or sorghum or corn, or it was a grain that was then processed into a position where it could be turned into a liquid. And stored that way, and that's how people. Yes, and then by the way, we also have this alcohol thing from the fermentation that happens to make us feel good, and that was a nice little side effect. But that's really where it all kind of came from.
Yeah.
And until it became a product into and of itself, mm-hmm. which probably wasn't that long after they figured out how to do it, anyways.
Do you think the market's getting oversaturated at all?
No, not really. You have to remember the number of breweries. Yes, so what was it, in 2015 or 2016, Brewers Association, who keeps track of all the craft breweries in the country, the United States finally crossed past the threshold of the number of breweries that existed prior to Prohibition. The peak in this country was somewhere around 3,600 or something like that. I forget the exact number. And in 2016, they finally passed that threshold. So we've now caught back up with pre-prohibition. Now, you have a population base that's 10 times the size now.
Right, yeah.
So you have some of that. But people come up going, well, how are you going to do it? Well, it depends on the size. Are you going to have tens of thousands of Sierra Nevadas around? No. Are you going to have thousands and thousands of New Belgiums around? No. Or Sam Adams? No. What you'll have is you'll have facilities like ours and even smaller that will provide just enough product for their local market. We don't do any distribution. We basically focus on the Castle Rock entity and people that come down to Castle Rock to visit. But we're not trying to ship it to like Illinois or to Maine or anything like that. That's not part of our business model at the moment.
Yeah.
And you'll probably see more and more of those types of things. going back into, you, if you use England, again, is the basis heritage of what we do here, but also a lot of what America is, kind of mirror images off of, is in the 1830s, as of 1838, and I've got statistical books to show it, they had 47,000 licenses to brew beer in England in 1838.
Wow.
And that does not include Scotland or Ireland, which had their own licenses. 47,000. Now, the vast majority were ones that were basically local. You have a pub, and they were happy to be making their own beer in the back. It was that local. So they weren't. You go to the next town down, you wouldn't find that one. You'd find someone else's. So you'll probably end up with a little bit more of that here in this country, but we'll see.
Hmm. So what has been the hardest thing about starting a brewery here in Castle Rock? Was it 2016?
When we opened the public, yeah. Early 2016. We opened January 16th.
Okay. So what has been the most difficult thing throughout that time of opening a brewery?
Probably some of the education aspects. Though we are focusing on those classic styles, you have so many people that are coming in and out of the beer scene, they may not always be familiar with what certain things are, or there's a misinterpretation or a miseducation on certain stuff. So it's the ability to show people what these are, where they're coming from, how they're relating to certain things. You've been in enough. When we have someone new come in, we'll ask, and they'll, oh, we're brand new, I don't know what I like. Okay, well, what kind of beers do you usually go for? We'll ask them that, brand names, everything else, because that gives us a baseline of where they're coming from, what education level they might have. So, oh, I like this, or I like this. Okay, here, try this one, try that one, try this one, and start telling them the story of what these styles are, where they come from, and what they should look for, what they should not look for. So it's really an educational level. That's probably the hardest thing, because so many people come in with a preconceived notion of what breweries are and craft beer as a generality, and it's maybe not what they're looking for. They may be a major domestic macro style beer drinker, and to them the craft scene has always been, oh my god, they're going to be really, really dark and thick, and I'm going to have to chew it, and they're going to be so alcoholic, or they're going to be so bitter that my tongue's just going to go to the back of my throat.
Or there's going
to
be peach in it.
Yes, or they have fruit. And sometimes that's actually that helps them, because it's something a little more familiar.
Right.
But then they're presented with something very easy, like a cream ale, or a red, or a very classic brown, and they go, wait, that's really nice, and it's smooth, and it's not thick, and it's not overly bitter. And so you're trying to open up that kind of that aspect of their brain, going, here, try this. It's not what you think it is. Try something else.
Yeah.
And so it's breaking through that wall. And sometimes for certain people that's easier, and for others it's a real battle. And that's part of what we do. We're here to kind of educate people about what it is we do, where it is beer comes from, where the heritage of it is, what Americans are used to, and what they have kind of forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So it's working on that.
Yeah. The other week, my wife and I went on vacation up in the mountains, and we went to a couple breweries up there. And one of the things that I noticed specifically at one of them was almost, I think, over half of what they are offering were IPAs.
Yes.
And I personally don't care for IPAs all that much. I'll drink them, but like it, to me, you drink one, you're full, and you're kind of burpy, and that's it. And you feel a little uncomfortable, and so it's not my cup of tea. And so I was just like, well, I guess I'll have the one of those three that aren't IPAs. And so that seems like a big trend.
It is. It's microbrews. Within the craft scene, it's been the biggest selling category, quote unquote, for the last 10, 15 years running. Mm-hmm. It's the craft brewing industry has really kind of grown with the IPA category. That's where the bread and butter has been made. And there's been a lot of really kind of good stuff that's been put out there. But at the same time, you have a lot of ones that are out there that are just really kind of eh.
Yeah.
They're just, even if you're an IPA person, I myself love a good IPA, but I can't make it my everyday drink. But yes, you do have breweries that you walk in and they may have 20 selections. And yes, 16 of them might be IPAs. And it's just at a certain point you kind of look going, well, when is enough of enough on that particular style without having some breadth? The argument we'll always get back is, oh, well, each one has some different hops and different flavor profiles. And I get that. I would like a little more variety of choice instead of just, oh, well, I've got 14 different versions of IPA. That's nice. Rotate those through.
Hoppy to me, all
yes.
of them.
Yes.
You know. you did, is it still on there? Yeah, the black IPA.
Mm-hmm.
I actually haven't had that one here yet, but one of my friends did, and they really like that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a category. That's one that some people aren't, even if they're IPA people, they may not be familiar with black IPAs. And there's two kind of trains of thought on where you kind of come from those. An alternate name for them can also be what's known as a Cascadian dark ale.
Mm-hmm.
Cascadian meaning from the Cascades, usually the Great Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, where the Cascade Mountains are. Is that people will start tanking what would be almost like a black lager that you'd find coming out of Germany, stuff like that, and they would use an ale yeast and maybe have a little extra hops to them because that's part of where the West Coast style came from, was that region. The other way to approach it is how we've done it, is instead of trying to take a black lager and making it an IPA, is we take a stout and then just add extra hop level to it. The stouts can really kind of, they can take some extra hopping really easily because you have so much going on and so much complexity, yeah, so that it's easy to really kind of boost a hop level to a nice IBU number without actually becoming, oh my God, bitter.
Yeah.
And so that's the way we approach it. But it's just two different philosophies of thought.
I didn't know that. That's cool. Yeah, because I like stouts, and so if you add a, that makes sense. Huh. So we've talked about what's the hardest thing. What brings you the most joy in having your own brewery?
Oh, I love chatting with people. I mean, working in the back and doing the brewing itself is fun, and we experiment a little bit, and we play, and you've had enough of them. We play in the history aspects of things, and heritage beers. We've got one on right now, and we've done a couple in the past where you bring that element of history back, a recipe that hasn't been maybe brewed on a commercial scale in 100 years or 200 years or more, and put it together and put it out there and put it in front of people, and everyone drinks it and goes, wait, this is good. How old is this recipe? 250 years old? Yeah. Wow. It shows you how much beer hasn't changed in certain ways, and yet how much it has on other hands. That's fun, chatting with people, just getting to know them. The community that we've kind of built around our little brewery with our Mug Club members and some of our other regulars who come in, and getting to know them and their lives, and watching them, people get married and have kiddos, and being able to watch the kiddos grow up. It's fun. That's part of what this is. It's a community place where we get to chat with people and see how they're doing, and say, oh, hey, Bob, how are you doing? How's the wife? I heard she was sick the other day. It's that community aspect that which was lost in America for so long. And now it's starting to kind of come back within the craft beer scene, within the kind of craft winery scene. Those kind of elements are starting to kind of reappear, and people are starting to look local again instead of being completely focused on the external world and, oh, I need to know what news is happening in Chicago today. Do you need to? I mean, yes, it might affect you long term, but why not know how's your neighbor doing two doors down? Is his mother out of the hospital? Are they doing okay? Did the little kiddo who skinned his knee, is he doing all right? We know he had a cold too. That's what you want to know. You want to know how people are doing on a local level, because it's easier to connect with them because you're seeing them face to face. Being able to connect with someone in Chicago from here, yeah, I guess you can with social media and new tech and everything else. Right. Yeah, you could see people, but does it have as much of an impact on your life as the people that you are living in the same community with? No. And that's what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I think Christianity, at least certain parts of Christianity, are starting to find is I'm seeing more movements of some church plants are starting to meet in pubs and breweries. I lived in Michigan for 3.5 years, and what they started there was beers and hymns. And like they'd go to the pub and have a beer, and they'd sing some hymns together. Theology on Tap is something that not just New Hope is doing, but many churches across the country are doing, because if you did a Theology on Tap at the church, hey, let's come and we're going to discuss this topic. Nobody's yes. coming, right? Nobody's True. Coming to the church for that. But you say, hey, we're going to meet at this local brewery and have a beer and discuss it. People are like, oh, I could do that.
All of a sudden it makes it a social activity.
Yeah.
And people have enjoyed it. And that's part of how humanity as a generality works, whether it's Christianity or not. You see that all over the world when it comes to religion and politics and social gossip. And that's what these places are. It's what the Brits do in the pubs. It's what the Germans do in the beer halls. It's what the French do in their cafes. Yep. I mean, it may not be beer, but it's still a social activity. It's a drinking activity. You see that all over.
You need food or drink to gather.
Yes,
around, right?
not always alcoholic. I mean, right. they can go any ways, but that's why you see group gatherings at places like at breweries and pubs and wineries
coffee shops,
yeah. Everything else. In many ways, the coffee shop is kind of more of a modern entity, but it's picked up off the French side. And again, it's the same idea. Mm-hmm. It's someplace for people to meet around a beverage or two and chat about anything under the sun.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like you said earlier, it's kind of that social lubricant that people will express more and talk a little bit more about stuff that they normally wouldn't because they feel a little held back.
Yes.
I remember it's almost a year and a half ago now, our Theology on Tap we had here in January 2017. It was on a Thursday night. It was the night before an inauguration. Mm-hmm. And our topic was patriotism and protest and how faith influences both those sides. And we had a big group. And the night before inauguration, everybody's, you know, there's all kinds of emotions going into that for people and all different kinds. And we had a whole slew of people that were all different perspectives, right? We had conservative, we had liberal, we had people that were atheist, people that went to church their whole life, and we all came together around beer to talk about this.
Yes.
And it was great.
And that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want the conversations to happen. It's just a question of where. Mm-hmm. And I think for certain people, yes, sometimes having conversations, whether religious or political or anything else, in a formal setting like a church, sometimes might give them a little bit of that kind of that creepy, I don't feel comfortable about talking about it. But you put them in someplace else that's public, I'll go, oh, well, no, I'd rather have that conversation here. It makes me more at ease. I don't feel as pressured or as officially responsible for, I mean, however you want to put it.
I don't feel like God's watching me. that big stained glass window of Jesus is not staring
exactly.
at me.
Maybe there's a little bit to that. It's because it's all mental. But you want people to be able to engage in the conversation on their own terms, and that's the kind of facility we have. We've hosted here. We host your guys' group, Theology on Tap. We've hosted a couple of political events here. A senatorial candidate for Colorado did a quick little meet and greet here.
Nice.
And we've had a gubernatorial candidate do a meet and greet here, and the place was packed for that.
Nice.
And does it matter what the political philosophy is? No. Do we as owners or bartenders maybe want to agree with everything or disagree with everything? No. But the point is that we're providing the facility. We're providing the venue. Mm-hmm. Something that's a little bit easier, more casual, where you can have that stuff without having it at town hall. Mm-hmm. So much of government throughout the history of humanity hasn't been dealt with in town halls or city halls or senatorial rooms or anything else. It's always dealt with in the public venue out somewhere else.
Yep.
In the pubs, in the beer halls, in the cafes, in the parks, in the wherever. America was founded on that. We built it on that. The revolution to break away with the taxation without representation was all planned and dealt with out of pubs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the American culture. It's part of just the heritage of where we are and where we come from. And I think Prohibition really put an end to that and made people kind of look for other escapes and other places to do it. And with craft brewing, it's really started to come back to that, which is nice. It's got a place in American history and in the American social scene and political scene. It's just, I think people need to kind of understand and not be worried about, well, what are people going to think if I'm going to have a conversation about God or whatnot while having a pint of beer in a brewery? Well, you're at least having the conversation.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I think about, personally, for me, some of the most meaningful, deep conversations I've had with people about God have happened in pubs or breweries or bars. That's where it's happened, you know? Not in my office at church, not in the grocery store when we run into each other, but it's at a brewery.
Yeah. And that's not to say that, like having someone come to your office. That's good for a private setting. If they need to talk about something private, awesome, totally. And those are the proper venues for that. But if you're going to have a group gathering, yes, go somewhere.
Yeah.
Whether it's here in Calgary, go down to Festival Park and park around that new bonfire, gas bonfire thing they have.
Yeah.
On a nice cool evening. or having a group meet up after a concert somewhere. You can do it anywhere. Mm-hmm. We just happen to be a place that people can choose to come here, or they can go elsewhere.
It's exactly.
Giving someone the idea to go be comfortable wherever they're comfortable, not just because, oh, well, it has to be here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And so interesting, the history of Christianity and alcohol or beer. We talked about that kind of at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I wrote something down here that I worked at a church in Michigan while I was going to seminary. And I did the youth and children's stuff. And what happened was the town I worked in had been a dry town up until 2005. Mm-hmm. And there was this new restaurant opening in the downtown area. And our church was like half a block away. And this restaurant wanted to put in a bar in their restaurant, which was maybe from here to the end of the table.
Half the size of our bar.
Yeah, a small bar. And they could do that, but they were smart and they knew the culture of the town. And so they asked the churches around them. They said, are you going to be okay with this? And I remember our church, the council, the session, the whatever you want to call it, met, and people from the church came in and gave their concerns of why we shouldn't say yes to this. And it was very interesting to sit back and watch that. And because I was in seminary and I lived a block away from New Holland Brewery in Holland, Michigan, and we would go there all the time, and our seminary would go there for Theology on Tap every Friday. Yeah. And but you know, somewhere along the way, I think specifically in the 1900s, all of a sudden somebody somewhere labeled it as evil, and now we're kind of reclaiming that.
Yes, I think the Prohibition movement and the what became known as the teetotalers really had an issue with it, and they took it from they took issue with alcohol as a generality, I think, from a moral standpoint, because you have humans. You're dealing with flawed individuals, and will some people overindulge? Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do it regularly. It's a part of humanity, and I think that was what they were worried about. And they took it upon themselves to say, well, our moral standing is so superior that we need to make sure everyone else adheres to this. And they were able to drive a movement together and put together. But in this country, what they did is they basically, it's not like they eliminated it. What they did is they made it seem more taboo than it should have been. Mm-hmm. And they drove it underground.
Yeah.
Because you had the speakeasies pop up. You had organized crime with the mafia and those guys take on it, because they started running booze. It became its own industry because it wasn't going to go away. This was part of what kicked off some of the revolution, is this overtaxation on beer and rum and other alcohol. And even after we fought the Revolutionary War, one of the first issues that President Washington had to put down was the rum rebellion, the whiskey rebellion. Mm-hmm. Because the government needed the brand new fledgling American government needed to pay for some of the war debts, and they started putting taxation out on things, and one of the things they started taxing was whiskey. And so the whiskey rebellion pops up in the middle of the colonial, the what now are the states, but they're in the Virginia, North Carolina, and Maryland areas. And they had a real problem on their hands, because it's like, no, we just fought this war, so we wouldn't have this, but there had to be some kind of give or take. But there's not a moral issue, I think, with alcohol. You have to be aware of who you are and how much you're able to deal with. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to isolate liquor, specifically distilled liquor, that's one thing. But beer and wine, it's part of an everyday societal culture. I don't know. The Prohibition thing, I think, did a lot of damage to the American psyche about alcohol. And we're still recovering from that, because we here in the brewery, we have guys come in, they'll look at the menu and go, they could care less what it is. They're looking for the thing that has the biggest number in front of ABV, alcohol by volume. They want the biggest number. They don't care what it is.
Yeah.
They want it now and they want it fast. That's not part of what this culture is supposed to be about. You're here about flavor and about relaxing and everything else. So I don't know. It's a tough question, and even though Prohibition's been over for, God, coming up on almost 100 years now, mm-hmm. we're still wrangling with the issues of that.
Right. Well, I think the problem is it always takes so long for a culture to change. And when you get that in their psyche, and then I think also the last 20, 30, 40 years, any kind of image given through film, media, TV about alcohol is like the typical college kid partying.
Yeah, the overindulge.
You know, like the Hangover. And
yes.
There was a teenage movie called Project X once, and it was, you know, it's all about, those are kind of putting beer in the light of, this is what you use to get hammered.
Yes.
Right? Which...
And in many ways, that's an American issue.
Yes.
Because, yes, you'll always have teenagers all over the world. It doesn't matter what they're always going to do stupid stuff. Why? Because they're teenagers. It's part of learning. It's part of the human nature. Science is showing the logic aspects of their brain aren't fully developed, so they're running on emotion. I mean, that's part of it. You get that. But there's been this pent-up kind of issue, I think, in this country with alcohol because, oh, well, you're not allowed to have it. The youth drinking age for beer used to be, at least for in this state, 3.2% beer. Yep. Was 18.
18.
And then full strength beer and alcohol and wine started at 21. Well, why did we change that? Oh, we can't have 18-year-olds drinking? Why not? I mean, you go to France and yeah. you have kiddos drinking wine in primary school. I mean, it's a part. Are they drinking like a 21% or wine? No, they're probably drinking that something that's around the 5 or 6%.
Right.
But it's part of the culture. It's part of what it is. In England, you have yes, the official drinking age, quote unquote, is 18. But so many people go into the pubs and they're with their dad or with their mom, and they know who the bartender is. They know who the publican is and everything else. And they get to know, it's like, okay, yes, if you could see above the bar, they will hand them a little half pint glass of some of a mild that's like 3.2%.
Yeah.
Let the kids, you get, the, if you take away the mysticism of alcohol, then all of a sudden in this country where you have that, oh, it's forbidden, it's taboo, I'm not allowed to have it. So therefore, I want all of it.
Yeah.
Get rid of that and that issue will go away.
I get what you're saying, yeah. That, yeah, especially kids, they always want what they can't have.
Always. Right? It doesn't matter what it is. The toy they were playing with for 10 minutes and were bored with it and they left it to the side and it's like, okay, and mommy goes and picks it up to put it in the box. Oh my God, that's when hell breaks loose. I was playing with that toy. No, you weren't. It was sitting over there. You hadn't touched it in 20 minutes. it's always that.
Yeah.
And it's that with, and humanity deals with that on all levels.
Uh-huh.
You always want what is being taken away from you or what you can't have. Not because you're really utilizing it at the moment, but because the image of it, it's disappearing. It's being taken from me. Well, yes, there's some of that.
Yeah.
But it's a larger moral conversation. And it's a hard one to have because, yes, you don't want kids who are learning to drive vehicles. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a one-ton piece of steel rolling down rolling down a road 50 miles an hour or more. Yeah, you don't want them drinking and have, but in the comfort of privacy of homes and with adult supervision, I'm not sure if I have an issue with it.
Yeah, that's a difficult, there's so many things going on with it, but I think one of the points I hear you trying to make was that if we keep it away, so you can't have this, and then they're like, well, I'm going to go with my friends and find this, and we're just going to, you know, drink, mm-hmm. that they set themselves up for bad drinking habits.
There is that. Or they immediately cross that 21 threshold and, oh my goodness, I get to have as much as I want. Yeah, you do. And we all learn that. At 21, 22, yeah, you get you're legal, you go to the bars, and you go bonkers for about 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get about 25 and you kind of go... Okay, I'm tired of that.
Your body is exhausted.
Part of it is, yeah, you're getting older, and so you can't quite recover as much. But it's just, it's not as much fun anymore. Now, some people almost never outgrow that, and that's a part of it, and a lot of people outgrow it sooner. But why have that magic kind of opening of the gate to a race where, and go! It's like, oh, no, stop. Just let it be.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think for me, growing up, just thinking of my journey, my wife would tell everybody that I was a goody two-shoes in high school, mostly because I was so afraid of God, and I didn't know it. and so I didn't drink at all till I was 21. And I think it was, and even then, when I was 21, I still had a journey yet through crisis of faith and things like that, where my mind shifted. But even then, I felt kind of guilty, kind of shameful for trying
for having a
alcohol.
Beer,
yeah,
in the middle
yeah.
of the day at noon or
yeah,
something. Yeah. It wasn't just at dinner and only one.
Uh-huh.
No, it's again, this is the Italians who are famous for their wines and their beers are okay. I mean, they don't have any issue. They have wine at every meal. They have
right.
wine at lunch. Shoot,
they,
have wine at breakfast if they
yeah.
get away with it.
Yeah.
The French do too. They love their wine and if anything, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts of it, that's more alcoholic than beer is.
Mm-hmm.
So why? And those are, and I mean, shoot, I mean, in Rome, that's the Vatican is there. From a Christianity standpoint, that is the basis
mm-hmm.
of where the kind of the religion kind of blossoms from in a lot of ways. And they serve wine at all of their masses. And
mm-hmm.
what's the problem? It's, I think the morality of this country has always been coming off of that teetotaler movement and the prohibition side is what really kind of drove it home is that you're guilty. That it's immoral. I'm going, why? Why is it immoral? Is it immoral for me to go out and get rip-roaring, raging drunk, get in a vehicle, put everyone else in danger, get home, and then start smacking? I mean, you have the typical, get home and start smacking on the wife
yep.
or beating the kids around. Yes, that's the immoral act.
Mm-hmm.
It's that. But the alcohol itself isn't it. It's just the alcohol in some ways maybe brings out some of the other deeper issues
mm.
that you may have.
Mm.
And for others, it brings out that kind of goofy side. I mean, if you've been around enough people, some people get, when they get a little inebriated, are really funny.
Yeah.
And they become slapsticky goofy. That's just a part of their personality. So in dealing with that, you have to deal with more of the core of the human person than it is the alcohol. If someone's got anger issues or if someone has these other problems that are morally bad, you got to deal with those at the crux of the problem. The alcohol is not it. All that does is maybe bring it to the surface.
Yeah.
So alcohol is just a tool. But even then, you don't have to go beyond a certain level. Some of that becomes self-control, and some of that becomes, no, like last night I had a beer and a half. Because you get to the end, and you get halfway through that last beer, and you're going, I'm just not feeling it. I'm kind of tired. I want to go to bed. So
yeah.
I don't need to finish it. We have plenty of people that come into the brewery, and they have what they want. And if there's a little bit left in the glass, and thank you very much. Thanks for coming in. How was everything? Oh, it was great. Awesome. They just didn't want to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
They know what their limits are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of part of what people have to learn with everything. You have to know what your limits are on intellectual capacity, on the ability to deal with businesses or deal with certain social situations
mm-hmm.
or people. Some people hate crowds. My limit on crowds is like 50 people. Okay. As long as I'm under that, I'm all right. I get into 1,000. You have people that are like that.
Yeah.
And so you have to learn that. And that's by artificially placing holds on people to experience that and learn about that until middle adulthood. I mean,
mm-hmm.
20s, early 20s is middle adulthood. That's the way society and culture has kind of always run itself. Are we living longer? Yeah. So could middle adulthood be redefined to 45? Yeah, maybe, but we haven't done it.
Yeah.
Because everyone, you get to 45, oh, I'm old. Going, you realize you're only halfway through your possible life.
Yeah.
So when you get to 70, how old are you then?
Yeah.
So culture has to adapt and has to modify itself. And you just have to really look at how do you want to deal with things. And some
well,
people are more willing to deal with the problem at hand, and others don't.
Built into our American culture, I think we have this sense of we don't have a sense of moderation.
No, it's
either,
all or nothing.
Yeah, it's all or nothing, and I think that works with
go big or go home is the American way.
with the alcohol thing too, of like, no, you can't have any, but when you're 21.
All of a sudden, the magic button is turned, and not only can you have beer, you could have wine, you could have liquor, you could have anything you want.
Yes.
Have at.
But we've never taught you how to moderate it.
No. We've been telling you no, 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 yes!
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Did I hear yes? Yes, you did. Ooh!
But anytime we try to teach to moderate,
mm-hmm.
people are like, don't tell me what to do. You can't tell me what to do. You can't regulate that. You can't.
And that's fair. And yes, and people have to learn it on their own. I mean, mm-hmm. on certain things, yes, you have laws and government restrictions that come in trying to enforce certain regulations on things. So like, can you go down to the local pharmacy and buy as much painkillers as you want?
Yeah.
No, they're not going to let you do that. There's certain elements. But again, I think from an alcohol standpoint, in all aspects of culture, there can be something set up and designed where it makes sense. Where even if you wanted to bring it down to the old 18 for 3-2 in this state is kind of going away. You still have it in certain states. But you can put an artificial restriction on, okay, you're allowed to have beer up to 6% alcohol mm-hmm. Starting at 18. Great. And then you can maybe graduate to wine and the higher alcohols maybe at 19. And then by the time you hit 21 and you start doing hard liquor, if you wanted to kind of leave it that way, that's fine. You already are understanding what alcohol itself is and what it's bringing about.
Yeah.
And you may not like hard liquor anyways. I mean, when you turn 21, I turn 21. Okay, yeah, you kind of go after vodka and maybe white rum because, it was pretty neutral. It didn't have a lot of flavor because, scotch, or gin, yuck. And now that I'm in my late 30s and whatnot, I'm really getting into whiskeys and scotches because they've got flavor profiles and palates and good tequila, not garbage tequila, but good tequila. There's stuff out there that's flavorful, but at 21,
Yeah.
Your palate changes over time, and that's a part of it. That's experience and everything else.
Bourbon's my choice now. You know,
and there's some really good bourbons out there, but at 21, 22, I couldn't stand the stuff.
My first drink when I was 21 was Jack and Coke
mm-hmm.
because I had soda in there.
Yes, that little extra sweetness, it helps. It does.
And then then I had a Blue Moon, and I was like, oh, I couldn't finish it. But my wife, who is my girlfriend at the time, she was buying the drinks, and she's like, you need to finish that because I'm paying for it.
Very nice.
So she kind of forced me to try and, you know, everybody says beer is an acquired taste. You kind of have to.
All alcohol is an acquired taste.
Yeah.
Because alcohol itself has an element to it. There's, I mean, as you get older, we understand what booziness is, and you could taste something and go, whoa, there's a chunk of alcohol in that one. You know when a drink, like a mixed cocktail, you know when it's been poured heavy and when it's not been. And, and yes, beer is an acquired taste because there are certain flavor profiles in there that are, unlike almost anything else you have in terms of food.
Mm-hmm.
Soda does not taste like beer, nor does it taste like wine. Soda is sugar. You start bringing that alcohol element into it. There's a heat to it. There's an astringency and a bitterness. I mean, if you've ever been around like a bottle of rubbing alcohol, you're not drinking the stuff. You just the smell of it, and you kind of go, whoa.
Yeah.
There's that to it because it's ethanol and methanol and there's elements in this. It's part of what it is, The earlier you're able to at least identify that and deal with it, the easier it becomes to be a little more accustomed to it and be able to move past that. It's like any brand new sensation or smell. That the first things that hit you are usually like, whoa, okay, hold on. But as you do whatever it is more and more, those initial sensations are put to the background. You're able to experience a greater depth of whatever it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel about the podcast and interview so far? You good with it?
Podcasts are fine by me.
Is there anything else you want to say or thought about, like things you did say? Like, well, I want to.
No, yeah. I part of before my before having the brewery, my background was in I've done radio for years, so I'm familiar with that. And just it's having conversations like this and a podcast, a long form podcast like this, allows the format space to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Within segmented radio stuff where you have so many commercial breaks and everything else, sometimes you'll have someone come in and do an interview. You see it, and people that understand media or take the time to kind of watch and learn, you see it on TV, you see it on this, you get 2 minutes to say whatever it is and you compact it as quickly as you can into something. You don't have time to take something and slowly unpack it and kind of let it breathe and develop it more. And that's the part of longer conversations. It's part of what you're doing with Theology on Tap. You're not just, here's the sermon and thank you, we'll see you next Sunday. It's no, let's take a section of something, not even a full sermon, maybe just a paragraph or two out of one of the certain books within the Bible or something, and let's unpack that. what are they talking about? What are they getting into? It's a form of study, and that's what podcasts are the same way. You're able to take any topic and let it flow. I mean, people that sit and listen to this will go, well, wow, you kind of bounce from topic A to D to back to F and E. You're all over the map.
Well, and hopefully
it's how conversations go.
When I got into podcasts, I was driving from Denver down to Castle Rock,
mm-hmm.
and I would just listen to podcasts on my way down,
yep.
on my way back, and it just made the drive a little bit easier. Especially more, I have a specific podcast I really like that a comedian does, and it's the same type of thing. It's a long form. They're probably like sometimes 2 or 3 hour
yeah.
long podcasts of them just having conversations.
And it is. It's you listening to a conversation and all of the twists and turns and the flow that a conversation has.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the time to pay attention to, for those that are listening, if you take the time to pay attention to your conversations that you have with friends and family, it's the same way.
Yeah.
You'll jump from topic to topic, and sometimes after 20 minutes of going, everyone has that moment going, how did we get to this topic anyway? You forget how, and you think back going, oh, that's right, it jumped from here to there, because it's how the human brain works.
Yes.
And so that's fun with the podcast, is you're able to participate in some small way in a conversation about a larger entity or topic, and wherever that path takes you is where the path takes you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why I've learned to take some notes from time to time, because I'm like, I'll remember that. We're going to come back to that. And,
exactly.
But if people want to know more about Castle Rock Beer Company, they can find you on Facebook.
We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We have our own website, CastleRockBeerCo.com, or you can do crbc.beer. Or just come on down to the tap room. We're right here in the downtown area of Castle Rock. We're right at the base of the rock on 6th and Perry in a giant round water tower building.
Mm-hmm.
People drive past and go, oh, that building. Yes, we're in here. Come on in. We're happy to sit and chat with you and say hi. It's a small family operation. It's myself, my wife, Jessica, and then my father, Charlie, who's here a number mm-hmm. of nights. And we'll sit and talk about almost anything under the sun.
Yeah.
It's part of what we enjoy. We like interacting with people. The beer is just kind of a thing to do it around.
Mm-hmm. It's great. I love it. I think what I really like about it is the laid-back atmosphere, where it does feel like you can talk with somebody and sit down and have a conversation. So,
yeah, without trying to scream across the table.
Yes, because other breweries I've been in, it's so mm-hmm. loud, and you just end up sitting there just drinking your beer.
Yes.
Even if you're with other people.
Yes.
You know? So thanks for joining us today and giving some insight about beer, alcohol.
A little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. So... and you feel good about it? Good. So thanks.
Thank you, Jordan.
All right.